Good evening. I'm Catherine Loper, News Director for WRVO Public Media. We're pleased to bring you the second in a series of six community forums on health topics, sponsored by the Health Foundation for Western and Central New York. Today we are discussing healthcare for veterans and active military in upstate New York. We are holding this forum at Jefferson Community College in Watertown, a region that is home to Fort Drum, one of the largest military facilities in New York State. The installation impacts all aspects of life here in Watertown and most certainly has an effect on healthcare. Fort Drum is the only major Army installation of this size without an inpatient hospital on base, so the community and soldiers are intertwined with each other when it comes to healthcare concerns. And also partly because of Fort Drum and for other reasons as well, the North Country is home to many veterans who face the same issues vets in rural areas all over upstate deal with in regards to getting quality healthcare. Military and veterans face specific healthcare needs, and their healthcare is also affected by the changes that civilian healthcare is undergoing in this country with the Affordable Care Act and other government funding changes. And also, I'd like to mention that the healthcare is an economic engine for this part of upstate as well. We'll be talking about all these issues. It has been said that how a society treats its military and veterans is a reflection of that society's values. So we are pleased we can discuss this very important issue at a location where this topic is so integral to the community. And helping us sort through this subject today, we have three expert panelists. I'd like to introduce first Denise Young. She's the executive director of the Fort Drum Regional Health Planning Organization. The group's mission is to analyze the regional healthcare system, identify gaps, and leverage resources to ensure high-quality healthcare services for soldiers, veterans, and their families. Denise is a longtime resident, a lifelong resident of the North Country, and has had family members serve in all four branches of the U.S. Armed Services. And we're also joined by Tom Carman, who's president and CEO of Samaritan Medical Center and Samaritan Keep Home, a not-for-profit community hospital and long-term care facility in Watertown. Tom also formerly served as president and CEO of Cortland Memorial Hospital in Cortland, New York. And he also serves on the Iroquois Healthcare Association Board of Directors and the Healthcare Association of New York State Board. And Richard Kazel is the external care line manager of the Medical Surgical Services at the Department of Veteran Affairs Medical Center in Syracuse. His management duties include overseeing primary care services at community-based clinics in Rome, Binghamton, Mesino, Oswego, Auburn, Ithaca, and right here in Watertown. He's been with the Syracuse VA Medical Center for over 30 years and is a member of the Board of Directors for the Central New York Health Systems Agency and the Health Advancement Collaborative of Central New York. All three of our panelists work together all the time on a regular basis through the Fort Drum Regional Health Planning Organization to coordinate healthcare for veterans and the military. So I'm very excited to have these three distinguished experts who know this topic way better than I do and will help us explore and sort this out. I wanted to start with explaining how healthcare is provided here in this area to active members of the military in particular, because this area is unique. As I mentioned in the introduction, that this is the only U.S. Army installation of this size without its own inpatient hospital right on base. So healthcare is provided in a different way. And so, Denise, I'd like to just start with you. If you can explain how this community provides healthcare to the members of the military who are on Fort Drum.
So it is a very much a partnership. It's a military community partnership that partners the medical activity on Fort Drum's primary care capability with the community's inpatient and specialty capabilities. So it creates a benefit for both the soldiers, families, and the civilian population. Because if we look at this market that we're in the health service area here, there's 160,000 people, and 40,000 of those are military beneficiaries. So by putting them all together, there's a greater range of services for both the soldiers and families and the civilian community. And so we have to work very closely together, and it's important that we do that. And in order to deliver that care, we are meeting the community providers, bringing the community providers together on a regular basis with the military providers. So there's a greater understanding, and this community is really unique in that. If you look at other communities across the country with military populations, you don't usually see the two sets of healthcare providers coming together. And by doing that, it's providing much better care for our soldiers and our families.
Well, and Tom Carman, I will say, I would think that in most communities that have a military base in their community, there's probably a bit of a divide between the medical services, between that for the soldiers and that for the civilians. If you could talk a little bit how, you know, how not-for-profit hospitals, you know, work with the military to provide that care in a situation like this.
Well, Catherine, it is quite a unique situation. As you and Denise have both described, this is a very, very integrated military-community partnership, and it truly is a partnership. It requires us to work very, very closely together. Samaritan actually is one of five hospitals within a 40-mile radius of Fort Drum, and that is critical. And for Fort Drum, they look at that those five hospitals as their hospital. I would note that Samaritan does do the lion's share of work, which makes us very unique. And for that reason, we have a very special relationship with Fort Drum. You know, we work very closely with them to make sure that we're providing services the way they would like them to be provided. We work with the MEDEC command. We work with the command of the 10th Mountain Division as well. But one of the unique things that we find is that, first off, we have to help soldiers and their families understand how this model works. Because oftentimes when they get assigned to Fort Drum, they look on post for the hospital, and the first thing they recognize, it's not there. So we need to help them that while the model is different, the care that they're going to receive is not any different. Next thing we would note is that many of the soldiers and their families will receive the same care exactly the same way a civilian would. They might get an order for a test, and they might come to the hospital, one of our outpatient clinics, and they're going to be treated just like any other civilian or any other member of our community. But there is also something very, very unique, and that is the fact that there are certain military physicians who actually see their patients in clinics that are owned and operated by the government, by the Army, but then ultimately come in and provide their services at the hospital, such as maternity. So during the entire course of a pregnancy, a woman might be seen in the private offices of Fort Drum and then actually have their baby at Samaritan Medical Center. So an Army physician comes to the hospital to deliver that child. That's also true for surgical procedures, particularly orthopedic procedures. So we have military physicians that come in. That then requires us to make certain that we are meeting the needs in those areas where we're serving the soldiers and their families. It also requires that we prepare for some of the things, such as their training. When you think about it, the Army does some fairly extensive and dangerous training, and so we need to be prepared for that and things like disaster preparedness and all of that. And then we also have to study and take a look at our services to make sure that they're designed and set up properly to meet the needs of soldiers and families.
And Rich Kazel, I think there's a correlation here. Many parts of upstate New York are far away from the nearest, you know, full-blown Veterans Administration hospital, Veteran Affairs Hospital, and so that presents some unique challenges for this area and all areas of upstate New York as well to provide that care. So there's also a crossover with civilian health care as well, I would think.
That's very true, and we're very much into healthcare delivery. So the hospital is there to support many of our healthcare delivery functions. We'll talk more later about telehealth and some of the other advances that we're doing. But just want to take an opportunity to say that we've had a physical presence at Fort Drum since 1993. We actually had an outpatient primary care clinic that was started there in October of that year. And was there until 1997, and then we moved it closer into the city for convenience and other reasons. But in 99, we opened a service persons transition exam program right in the counter troop clinic at Fort Drum, and that provided an opportunity for active duty military while in uniform to get a full comprehensive exam for compensation purposes, and that proved to be a model for the rest of the country. We brought in the elements of the Buffalo Regional Office that helped process that helped that process along. And in 1999, we opened our integrated disability exam system, and we're basically doing all of the disability exams for active duty military at Fort Drum. So we've had a very good presence up there and a very good working relationship with the MEDAC over all those years.
And just for anyone who doesn't know, somebody tell me the definition of MEDAC and what it is.
Medical activity, so the medical activity for the Army, so all of the activities that are happening under medical command on the installation.
So that would cover anything medical that's going on the Fort Drum base, correct?
Correct.
Okay, good. I can see you looking at our friends from Fort Drum to make sure we're correct. But I just wanted to make sure we clarify that for everyone. And I'll just say, if you're just joining us, you're listening to the second in a series of community forums on WRVO Public Media. I'm Catherine Loper, WRVO News Director. Today, we are discussing healthcare for veterans and the military in upstate New York. And I think some people might be wondering how a base as large as Fort Drum came to be without the typical hospital on base. And so if we could just sort of explore, you know, the history of it and how that came to be. Did you want to talk about that, Tom?
Certainly, I'd be glad to. That's a very interesting point. And when you think back to the mid-80s, Fort Drum, as we know it today, had been Pine Camp, and then it was renamed Fort Drum, and the 10th Mountain Division was stood up here in the mid-80s. And when that was done, the community leaders got together with Army leaders and began to think about what's the best way to design this base. And I think they began to look around and realize that we have enough healthcare in this region, particularly hospitals, so we probably don't need to build another hospital on post. They also recognized that they didn't need to build schools on post, and also realized that they could build some housing out into the communities, and that's where the 801 housing came from. So it was fairly well designed and thought through by community leaders and military leaders back in the mid-80s.
And then I would say probably a big change that came and affected the healthcare needs of this area and of the folks on base was 9/11. And Denise, if you want to talk about how that increased the need, you know, as the number of soldiers on base increased, and how did this area cope with that?
Well, certainly when we were looking at the 3rd Brigade coming, we had historically had 2 brigades, and another brigade is coming, and that's going to grow our population pretty significantly. Really, that was when we were formed, the Fort Drum Regional Health Planning Organization, to bring together the military and civilian leaders to talk about how we grow the system to meet the needs, not only just the bricks and mortar, because, of course, it took some bricks and mortars, but it also took providers, and it also took communication. So we needed to find out what the gaps were, what the needs were going to be, and build the system to meet that, because the needs of the young soldier population isn't necessarily the same need that the community population has. So certainly we had to think very distinctly about meeting the needs of the soldiers and families that were coming to us.
And what are some of those differences? I mean, what kind of medical specialists do you need that that the community doesn't need as many of?
Well, the reality is you're talking about a young, healthy population, young families. They have lots of babies. They need pediatrics. They have injuries, so PT and orthopedics. And so those kinds of things that you would expect a young, active, healthy population to have, as well as the behavioral health needs, and both educating our community about meeting those needs and making sure the providers are here when those needs need to go outside the gate.
And more mental health care?
Absolutely, more behavioral health, mental health care, yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Those are needs that our community strives to meet.
And Rich, the post 9/11 world brought a younger veterans population than had been seen in decades past. Typically, veterans seemed to be aging, and then suddenly as we went to two wars, the veteran population has gotten younger, while a portion of it has gotten older at the same time. How has that changed how you all are delivering veteran care and the kind of care you need to think about providing?
Both have very unique challenges, and as you look at an older population, we were doing a lot of planning in the late 90s for what we were looking at as the eventuality of World War II and Korean-era veterans and their challenges and needs that they were going to be presenting us, and then all of a sudden we have a younger population. I have to add, there's a lot more women in uniform, and as a result, we have a lot more women veterans. So we've made a number of inroads in terms of providing specialized services for the women veteran, both on an inpatient basis at the medical center and on an outpatient basis. All of our community-based locations have very specific exam capabilities with a lot of privacy built in and lots of ability to get the lab results that we need for that specific population. But as I look at it too, the behavioral health issues are extreme. We've dealt with developing a polytrauma unit to respond back at the medical center. There's about 13 employees dedicated to that. We have an OEF, OIF capability, which extends beyond the boundaries of the medical center and reaches out to all 13 counties of our catchment area. OEF is Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation in Iraqi Freedom. So those were early responses, and as time went on, they have now matured into services that are very specific to that, again, younger population and the families, I mean, because it's a family issue. We also, again, with the Behavioral Health, saw the development of PTSD. And there's a tremendous amount of activity related to that population. So we've geared up for that. We have also developed specialized services such as homelessness, homeless outreach. We don't look at people returning from active duty as necessarily going to be in that type of situation, but they certainly are. And we have a homeless outreach program right here in Watertown, and doing a great job, very aggressive. And we also have a veteran outreach program. I don't want to just talk about what we do through the formal channels, but we have a more informal channel. And right in downtown Watertown, there's a veteran outreach program, which meets the needs of people who don't want to go into the medical center, who are afraid of the governmental approach to things. And this is a less invasive process to get them into appropriate care. And they do travel a lot. We have an external van that travels, a very sophisticated unit that goes out into the community. So there's a lot of different things that are out there. I'm just touching on a few of them.
Right, and there are some peer-to-peer support programs. Yes,
absolutely.
Sort of a newer trend in mental health support and that sort of thing.
Yeah. That's emerging. I mean, that's growing as we speak. We're adding new employees that being trained to do that type of thing right now. Yes.
That's great. What would you all say are the biggest, and I'll go down the line, the biggest healthcare issues facing the active duty, you know, military soldiers here, and then for Rich, for the veterans? You know, what are the biggest healthcare issues? You've mentioned a couple of them, but what would you say are the ones that are the most challenging for you all as representing the healthcare provider side of things to address? Denise?
Well, probably the behavioral health care in terms of getting enough providers in the community. And that, you know, that's not just to our community. That's across this country. You know, there just aren't enough behavioral health providers out there. So that is a challenge for us to grow that system. And I think it's both on installation and off installation to have enough resources for that, for both the family members and the soldiers and the needs of the community. So that remains a challenge.
Tom?
Certainly, thinking of the challenges, and actually going back to your last question, let me start with that first, because since 9/11 and really the addition of the 3rd Brigade here, the hospital industry has really made some significant changes to really prepare itself for the additional troops that are here. We'd seen a steady state of about 10,000 troops since the mid-80s till about 2004-05, and we have about 20,000 on the ground today. So all the hospitals together, collectively, have had about $200 million worth of capital improvements, really to upgrade their facilities. Samaritan Medical Center has seen about $155 million since 2008, just upgrading its facilities, providing for a new emergency department, new surgical services, new critical care, and in renovating lots of the older hospital as well to prepare for it. To meet some of the challenges, in addition to behavioral health, as Denise noted, physician recruitment is critical for us as well. We did a gap analysis, tried to identify where the gaps were, worked with our TRICARE providers as well to see where they were having to send soldiers and their families outside of this community, and use that as a guide to really identify where the shortages were. And Samaritan's been able to recruit nearly 80 physicians since about 2007 to try to meet that gap as well. So I think physician recruitment and filling in the services that are so necessary for this community has been one of the other challenges that we've been able to respond to.
And Rich, for the veteran side of things, what would you think is the number one concern?
I can't really pin it down to one, but I would say that when we left Fort Drum in 1997, we had 1,058 enrolled veterans. Today we have over 3,700. So we've had to improve the delivery system significantly, and we have a contractual service up here. So I think one of my concerns is that as we get bigger, the ability to meet the needs contractually versus doing it with our own staff is being evaluated. So that's one thing that is an ongoing concern, and it's shared by others, and we're doing plans and so forth in that direction. But another thing is, and I go back to the independent disability exam system that we put in place in April of 2009, it gave us an opportunity to look firsthand at the active duty military population as they were coming through getting their disability exam through the VA. And a number of things that we were looking at as very serious concerns, again, were the behavioral health issues. Offshoots of that are suicide and suicidal approaches. The VA has ramped up tremendously in that area. We have in Canandaigua a unit that supports the entire VA of over 250 employees. So it is a center for a hotline, you know, calling for suicide prevention. But that to me is one of the big concerns, that on any given day, 22 veterans in the United States commit suicide. That's a staggering, staggering statistic. Every time I see it and listen to it, I just shudder, but it's reality, and we have to do much more to, no matter what we do, it's not enough to prevent it. We gotta do more. I gotta also say pain is a big issue with us. We're looking at pain management as a continuum. Some of those result in suicides, and I think that as we look at alternatives to medications and alternative modalities to reduce the pain, people at 28 years of age that are condemned to a life of pain, I mean, that's a very serious problem. So that's another area that we're very concerned about is the pain management.
We will continue our discussion about healthcare for the military and veterans in upstate New York in a moment. You're listening to a community health forum on WRVO Public Media. Welcome back to the second in our series of community forums on health topics. I'm Catherine Loper, news director at WRVO Public Media. We are discussing healthcare for veterans and the military in upstate New York, and I'm joined by our panel of regional experts, Denise Young, executive director of the Fort Drum Regional Health Planning Organization, Tom Carman, president and CEO of Samaritan Medical Center, a not-for-profit community hospital in Watertown, and Rich Kazel with the Veteran Affairs Medical Center in Syracuse. And Tom Carman, I just wanted to pick up on something you were talking about, physician recruitment. Is it also hard to retain those physicians in this area once you've recruited them?
You know, it is. Actually, the recruitment process can be challenging by itself, but frankly, it's no different than anywhere else in the country. There are a limited number of physicians, and they have lots of choices as to where to go. So it can be a challenge to try to recruit physicians, and particularly their spouses, to this region. But the fact of the matter is that we have a beautiful place that we live here. Four seasons, there's a lot to offer here. We often look for physicians or spouses who have a tie back to New York State. We've actually had some success with Canadian physicians as well that want to be close to the Canadian border. So there's lots of things that we have used to be successful in recruiting, which is why we have been able to bring in 79 physicians that have stayed with us. But that's the key, the retention part of it. Really, once we get them here, we want them to stay. And we find that once they've stayed for about 5 years, they'll stay for a lifetime. And so that really is the key, those first few years, trying to make certain that they get integrated into the community, are comfortable here, develop a good network, and really find this a great place, not only to work, but to live.
Denise?
And we're also seeing that our military physicians who, when they decide to get out of the military or they retire, they find the quality of life here. It's a great place to raise their family. They're integrated into our healthcare system, so they're very familiar with the community healthcare system. So it's very easy transfer that for them to stay here in our community. So we are seeing our military physicians retiring and being part of the community healthcare system.
And I'm also just wondering if there are certain, you know, specialties that are harder to get in, or is that part of the problem, just having specialists, or is it more of a problem having, you know, your family physician type? I'm sure once you have people who get used to this, working in this unique situation here, you want to keep them around. But are there particular specialists that this area needs?
There certainly are, and again, we look back to the gap analysis that was done, work with TRICARE, try to understand where the referrals are leaving this community. A couple of the areas that we have noted and continue to recruit, one would be an ENT or otolaryngology. That's an area where we currently have for otolaryngologists here in the community, but there is a greater need, and we continue to recruit. Gastroenterology, we currently have two in the community, but we could use more in that area as well. So it's typically in the specialty areas. We've just been successful rebuilding a urology program so that next summer we will be back to three full-time urologists. That's a tough specialty to recruit simply because not that many are trained. They have opportunities across the country, and you have to find the right fit for this region. So those are just some of the specialty areas, but quite honestly, primary care physicians can be difficult as well. We still have a shortage of primary care physicians, and that's an area that we focus on. I would note one thing, though, as we talk about physicians, physician recruitment, and particularly retention. The sense of the physicians in this community is one that is very supportive of the military. We have one of the highest TRICARE participation rates, I believe, of any military community across the country. It's in excess of 90%. That's because of this being a very unique model, but I also think it's because our physicians are very supportive, they're very patriotic, they understand, and they're greatly appreciative of what our soldiers and their families do.
And TRICARE means those physicians have been approved to treat members of the military, correct?
That's correct, Catherine.
Okay, great. And Rich, did you want to add anything about that, about specializations that are needed for the veterans hospitals and facilities?
Yeah, I'd just like to make a comment that the physician recruiting activity is extraordinary. And any organization is being faced with the same challenges, a growing population of people in need of service with at times now it's a shrinking population of providers. I personally do all the recruiting for our medical center. I have done that since 23 years now, but I 2008 I took the professional approach and I became certified, fellowship trained in physician recruiting. It's given me an opportunity to have a nationwide network of people who are doing the same things. I have an academic in-house recruiting organization I'm also very active with, because that's what it takes today. It takes that type of commitment. It takes that type of energy to be successful in recruiting. It's recruitment, retention, and relations. You've got to work with your medical staff. You've got to develop them. You have to have an opportunity to workforce plan with them, make them part of the process. So as we go through this, it's a combination of many different things that you have to consider in terms of meeting the total needs of specialty services, and takes combinations of full-time, part-time physicians. It takes contractual alignments and agreements. On-call is a big thing. Nobody wants to work all day and be on a call all night. So you have to factor those type of things in, and that's your retention issue. So all those different things coming together. I do contribute external of the VA to the community. So if I'm involved and I'm recruiting a physician, I work and help others with their needs as well. So I think that's another contribution that the VA does make.
That's great.
You know, we've talked a lot about physicians, but there are a whole lot of other folks that make up our healthcare system that need to be educated and need to go into the system. And I think because of this partnership and because of the planning that has been done on a regional basis, we have taken a very unique approach to building our healthcare workforce and have leveraged education programs from outside our community to come here to our community college. Bachelor's of Social Work programs, a Master of Social Work program is actually being delivered right here. The Nurse Practitioner program is being delivered at our community college. So we have taken the idea that we're going to bring education programs here, educate the local workforce, because they live here, they love it here, they want to stay here. And it also gives an opportunity for the military spouses who are here to take part in these education programs and be able to go back and provide that care to the soldiers and families. So,
and that's another good way to deal with the recruitment issue, is just to have folks homegrown that you can rely on and will stay.
And have had some, you know, significant success with that, because when we can graduate a whole cohort of nurse practitioners, those are family practice folks who are going to be prescribing and they're going to be providing primary care in our community, and they can take some of that burden off the primary care physicians. So it is another way for us to build the workforce.
We don't want to forget about our nurses, that's for sure. I wanted to talk a little bit about technological advances that I think is transforming the healthcare system, you know, for everyone, things like telemedicine. And if you could talk a little bit about how that is helping getting healthcare to members of the military, to veterans, when sometimes you don't have that physician or that nurse or that professional available where they need to be. Who would like to start off with that one?
Well, on installation, they do have a quite robust telemedicine program, and so they're using that all of the time to access their assets that are outside of this region at Walter Reed and other medical facilities. So it does allow that capacity to be brought here. In the community, we're also doing a number of pilots with telemedicine and telemedicine equipment, particularly around psychiatry. And even if that psychiatry is provided to community members, it frees up the system. So when we can broaden the access to care through telemedicine, it frees up the system to be able to provide more care to the soldiers and families.
Mm-hmm. And Rich?
Yeah, we had a very early experience back in 2000 and 2004 with developing a telebehavioral health component using a grant. It's called a Joint Incentive Fund. And we, in essence, set up a telemedicine capability at Fort Drum, and we had a psychiatrist in Syracuse. And it was very successful, and so that was a good demonstration of the technology. Syracuse VA has been using mental health for over 10 years now, so we're very used to that. But more recently, we have developed a full telemedicine capability. All of our community-based clinics now have telemedicine capabilities with two units in place. We can do a full range of otolaryngology, for example, cardiology. The most recent development will be EKGs, I should say, that will be able to be done through telemedicine. So there's a lot of applications. We're learning as we're going through this. There's a multitude of application potentials with the technology. One thing that we're developing right now also is teleretinal capability. For example, in our clinic here in Watertown, we have an optometrist who, through teleretinal capability, will be able to access in real time an ophthalmologist or a retinal surgeon back in Syracuse in real time with the patient actually physically being there in the clinic. So getting that real time consultation is a very important development. And again, it saves time and it could save somebody's eyesight. So that's another great advantage of technology that we have.
That just sounds amazing to me. I mean, the leaps and the bounds that the technology are taking just change rapidly. For those who haven't participated in telemedicine, do you have any way to sort of quantify how often it's being used or how much?
Again, we're in the last year was really our full development year and getting the equipment out and getting it tested, and now we're going out and developing the clinical applications. You have to, you know, look at it as starting a new clinic. So we have providers on one end, and we have an LPN and RN at the clinic site who is presenting the patient. And there's patient education that has to be done in advance and other requirements. But it's hard to quantify that in the early stages. Some things like teledermatology, for example, go pretty rapid because it doesn't take more than 10 minutes to get the area of the skin that's being looked at. So that those are pretty rapid fire. Other things with a full exam capability, maybe half an hour, 45 minutes, like a regular exam. So that it takes more time. But we'll have better numbers out there as we're going along. We're meeting our target. We're just under our target for this year. It was, and we may, I don't think we're going to make it because the end of the year is coming up. We end at the end of September. So we were very close to making it.
That's great. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the second in a series of community forums on WRVO Public Media. I'm Catherine Loper, WRVO News Director. Today, we're discussing healthcare for veterans and the military in upstate New York. We were just talking about how telemedicine is transforming healthcare for everyone, but being used for members of the military and veterans alike. And I wanted to talk about electronic health records because that's something else that is making a big change in healthcare and in some areas a little slowly, and the road has been bumpy. But Tom, maybe you could talk to this. I'm curious if there's any issues of dealing with medical records between the military world and, you know, community-based hospitals like your own.
So with the area of electronic medical records, we've made some significant advances in this community. We're really very proud of what we've been able to do. We secured a HEAL grant back about 3 years ago. It's a $7 million HEAL grant. And the purpose of that grant was for us to study COPD, a chronic illness. But we were able to actually put electronic medical records in all of our primary care physicians in the three-county area. Don't think we noted this before, but when we talk about the communities that serve Fort Drum, it's a 40-mile radius, and that does include Jefferson, Lewis, and Southern St. Lawrence County. So we were able to put EMRs, electronic medical records, in each of the primary care physicians in each of those communities, connect them all together. All of them were then certified as at a level two or three patient-centered medical home, a level of quality, an indicator of quality, I should say. And in addition to that, have them all qualified for meaningful use, which was very, very important. We then are in the process of having them all connected into the health information exchange. That is extremely important to be able to have information flowing back and forth. And from an efficiency standpoint, it really will be helpful to patients and their providers to be able to go into the health information exchange and actually see that a test was done last week at another provider and be able to call that information up and not to have to repeat that is very, very important. So when we think about the relationship to the military, that health information exchange is extremely important to them. They've actually programmed into their processes that they look at that health information exchange record each time a patient comes in to visit them. And so it really is important. Now, the challenge that you did ask about is that, yes, they do have a firewall, so we can't just interface with them directly, but allowing them to get into the health information exchange for that data that they need is one way to get around that.
Interesting. And Rich, do you experience that issue as well between, because veterans, you know, go to regular doctors as well as VA doctors?
Right. That's always been an ongoing problem. Again, the potential and the opportunity to use that system is in place, and we're in the beginning stages of that as well. We have our own firewall. I got to bring that up. So there's a lot of restrictions with medical information that the federal government puts on us. So we're lagging behind, actually, and Fort Drum is way ahead of us in that regard. One area of concern, though, I do raise is that when we work with the ALTA system, which is the electronic medical record system for the military, for the Army, we have Vista A, so the two are not compatible, and it does raises a lot of concerns because they don't integrate very well. They're working on patches, they're working on different things to smooth that out. But when we work where the disability exam program here in Watertown, we actually have two different screens. So we're working simultaneously two different systems that we have to meld together. So that is a problem, and that's a challenge that we have to overcome.
And is you said that's being worked on. Is there...
We had the opportunity to query the Secretary of the Department of Veteran Affairs. He was in Syracuse, and he gave us some encouragement, but it's been an ongoing process for many years right now. So I can't really say, you know, if there's a solution on the horizon. I can only say what he told us is that they were working on something that would be like an app, like you have on your cell phone or like your tablet. And if you push that app, it does all the machinations and combines the two records together. So you don't have to do the laborious process that you would have to do otherwise. So that's what they're working on, and that's what they're planning right now.
Well, sometimes it's hard for civilian doctors to get medical records to other civilian doctors, so this is no surprise.
And I was the one that asked them that question because it is very prominent in the opportunity to improve it is there.
That's great. I want to turn now to something that's, you know, just on the horizon or around the corner, and that's the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And that obviously is going to affect the civilian healthcare system greatly. And there's a lot of confusion in the civilian world for how exactly it's going to affect everyone. And I think it hasn't really been covered that much how it might affect, you know, any military and families, if at all, but I think veterans in particular, that will have more of an effect too. So let me just start maybe with Denise. Will there be any impact for military and veterans because of the Affordable Care Act, or will they just see, because of the way this is changing, you know, civilian facilities, that might affect them that way?
It won't affect them in the sense that it will affect the civilian population in terms of their insurance coverages. So that impact they will not feel. But it's certainly within the community and the impact of the Affordable Care Act and how we manage care for patients. So as we change how we manage care for patients and how we pay, as we pay better attention to taking care of the total patient, and Tom mentioned the patient-centered medical homes, and that really is about taking care of the total patient in both the Army medical home and the civilian community patient-centered medical homes, that how we take care of people and trying to take care of the whole person, that certainly they'll feel that on their installation, and we will in the community. So in that sense, they'll see that change. But as far as insurance and all exchange stuff that we've been hearing about, that will not impact directly our soldier and family population.
But Tom, that will affect your hospital, the Affordable Care Act, in a lot of different ways, but I guess it'll primarily affect your civilian patients.
That's correct. It really will have the greatest impact on the civilian patients, and it hopefully will improve access, allow many more people to have insurance that don't today. That's really the good side of the Affordable Care Act. There's so much uncertainty as to exactly how it's going to roll out and what the impact will be. I think that's hard to predict at this point. I know that one of the concerns I do have is relative to if we see continued reductions in payments, that may impact some of the services that hospitals ultimately can provide back to their communities. That would be a concern. But as Denise noted, some of the good side of it is the fact that we will be more focused on populations of patients, trying to improve levels of care for everybody. We actually have a disease registry in this community, which will allow us not only to have an electronic medical record, but begin to take a look at the overall population health of our community and begin to identify how we're treating the chronic illnesses of diabetes and COPD and CHF and things like that. So I think there's some real opportunities for improving the level of care, which ultimately helps Fort Drum and our civilian community. But there's certainly a lot of uncertainty with what's going to happen with the AC Act as well.
Right, and there's a lot of emphasis on primary and preventative care, which has an effect on acute care facilities as well.
It does.
Mm-hmm. And Rich, what are you telling veterans and especially their families about, you know, this upcoming Affordable Care Act and what they should be doing right now?
Well, what we've been saying is that the consistent message is if you're enrolled as a veteran and you're enrolled in veteran healthcare, that doesn't necessarily mean you have to be coming in all the time and receiving care. But if you're using us and as infrequently as coming in once a year just to touch base with us, then you don't need to purchase any additional insurance. You are covered. So that's the good news. And we are encouraging other veterans who are not enrolled in care to look at this as an opportunity to get enrolled in veteran health care. And that's what we're doing. We're doing some rather aggressive marketing our services and how to get enrolled in our services. So that's what we're doing right now. The problem, of course, is the family. VA health care doesn't necessarily extend beyond the veteran unless you're 100% service connected, and the spouse can receive veteran health care until they reach 65 when they're eligible for Medicare.
We will continue our discussion about health care for the military and veterans in upstate New York in a moment. You're listening to a Community Health Forum on WRVO Public Media. Welcome back to the second in our series of community forums on health topics. I'm Catherine Loper, news director at WRVO Public Media. We're discussing health care for veterans in the military in upstate New York, and I'm joined by our panel of regional experts, Denise Young, executive director of the Fort Drum Regional Health Planning Organization, Tom Carman, president and CEO of Samaritan Medical Center, a not-for-profit community hospital in Watertown, and Richard Kazel with the Veteran Affairs Medical Center in Syracuse. And we are just talking about the Affordable Care Act and how that's going to affect civilian health care in this country and how that might affect veterans in particular. I just also wanted to talk about other government funding of health care and because it's so much in the news these days, sequestration, the federal budget battles, Medicare, Medicaid, et cetera, and what to do about Medicare and Medicaid and the funding of both of those huge programs. And I'm just wondering, you know, on we hear about these programs in the abstract, but how does it really affect you all as, you know, healthcare providers and people who are concerned about healthcare provisions on a daily basis? Or what are your concerns, you know, as we're going down the line in the future about how this is going to affect healthcare, particularly in upstate New York? Rich, do you want to start with that?
Well, I think the impact, and I'll let the other panel members talk more about sequestration and its impact at Fort Drummond and Medac, because it's rather significant. For the VA, we've been impacted by the sequestration to date, although I am preparing a budget with sequestration impacts in it. So as we move into our fiscal year, actually begins next week, so FY14 starts with contingency planning for potential for sequestration. So we have those type of things that we have to look at. But to date, we have not been impacted by the sequestration process.
Well, that's good to hear. Yeah. And unusual, I think, because I know, you know, there's been a lot of impact elsewhere. Tom, did you want to speak to that?
I would, and I would know, like Rich said, that for Samaritan Medical Center, sequestration really has not had an impact yet. We were able to budget for that. We anticipated it. We certainly hope that it doesn't continue. I would note that as I look around the community, particularly at Fort Drum, sequestration had a fairly significant impact, particularly on the civilian workforce at Fort Drum and the furloughs that they had to sustain over a period of time. That was unfortunate, and I think that even resulted in some turnover as a result of that, which is most unfortunate. What I would like to know, Catherine, as you start to think about some of the cutbacks from the government and Medicare, Medicaid sequestration, is I think what that's really doing is shining a light on this model as a model that the military may want to adopt in other communities. And I think the military, particularly the Army, is recognizing that this is a very efficient and economical model, one that provides high quality. Yes, it's unique, it's a little bit different, but once you get over that, it provides a very high quality service. And might this not be a model for other communities? When you start to think about government funding, whether that be Medicare, or military funding, or even Medicaid, you bring those all together and can provide them in a community hospital as opposed to a military hospital or a community hospital, you can have some real advantages. The other thing, and particularly I would note for this community, the fact that we've developed it this way since the mid-80s, and the fact that Fort Drum doesn't have a hospital, it allows us to have a larger community presence. And as a result of that community presence, healthcare is often about scope and size. That allows us to have services in this community that you might not find typically in a community of this size if we had a competing hospital on post. One example of that I would note is the fact that we have a level 2 neonatal intensive care unit. You might not find that if it wasn't for that joint population being served by the community hospital. I would also note our medical staff. We've got about 170 physicians on staff representing about 40 specialty services. And again, you might not find the breadth of services in a community that didn't have that uniqueness that we have here.
And Denise?
Well, if we're talking about Medicaid and Medicare cuts, the struggle with it is that they have to figure out if they're going to continue to cut, that it's not just cutting, it's figuring out how we deliver it more effectively in a more cost-effective manner. You can't just cut from the pay-for-service and fee-for-services that are given. It's not going to work. And so that's what we're seeing is how do we deliver it differently, and how do they pay for it differently. And then as far as sequestration goes, the military, I think, has felt the impact of sequestration in such a much more significant way than the civilian community has. And, you know, I don't think Fort Drum is any different than that. And we certainly hope that this is not going to continue and continue to put that pressure on our military, which is already doing a very hard job for our nation. And we don't want to see them have to make that job harder.
I think Tom brought up an interesting point that this is a unique model that might you know, be something to be looked at in different parts of the country. But as you said, this has been grown over a period of time and has been able to grow with the changes in size of the base and of the population. I wonder, and I think either Denise or Tom could speak to this, you know, if another area that has a large military base suddenly lost their, you know, base hospital, it would be hard to emulate this, I would think. And you know, even though this is probably a very economical model, that would you know, be a very difficult thing to recreate, I would think.
It would have to be thoughtful. It would have to be planned. They would have to take time to bring the assets together as they have here. You know, bringing the community and the military together to plan for that change. I don't think it's not, I think it's very doable if it were planned well. There's certainly, we have been through our growing pains, so there's a lot of lessons learned here and a lot of things that can be replicated as long as it's a thoughtful process and it's a joint and collaborative process that benefits both the soldier and military population as well as the community population. That's why it works. That's why healthcare works here, is because there's a mutual benefit for bringing this together, and in particularly in a rural area. So if it's thoughtful, if they think about where they're going to do it, because if it's a population like ours, it will work.
And Tom, speaking of this being an economic model and how the community has benefited by having more, you know, medical resources because of Fort Drum's presence here, at the same time, this has also helped the economy of this area too. If you could speak to that a little bit.
Certainly. Fort Drum has been a tremendous economic engine for our community. Each year they do publish an economic impact statement of what their impact has been, and that historically is over $1 billion a year. Very significant both from the operations as well as the capital improvements they're making out on post as well. So it is a very significant part of our economy.
We are about running out of time, but this is such a huge topic, and I'm sure there are things that I have left out. So I want to give each of you the opportunity to kind of, you know, wrap up and mention anything that I forgot to ask you about. But just, you know, for our listening audience, what do you think are the things that we as a society should be looking towards the future for, you know, making sure that we give our military and our veterans, you know, the healthcare that they need and providing that healthcare in this ever-changing healthcare environment? Rich, maybe I'll start with you.
I think we have to be prepared for fluctuations. I've been around the system long enough to seize the peaks and valleys, and you can't have that. You have to be consistent. You have to create a funding stream that is going to be less influenced by the political system and more influenced by the needs of our active duty and our veterans.
And Tom?
I think we have to do everything we possibly can for our soldiers and our families. They're putting their lives on the line for our benefit, and I think we as a country need to continue to support that. We are very fortunate to have this unique model here in this community. We have to be very understanding and empathetic towards our soldiers and their families as well. Some of us as civilians might not appreciate the fact that some of our soldiers have gone through 4, 5, and 6 deployments over the course of the last decade. That is significant, and we need to support them in any way that we can.
And Denise?
And I think we don't know what we don't know, because this is a war that has gone on a long time, and we don't know what those impacts will be for the families and for the soldiers over the long haul. And I don't think we can, you know, I don't think there's that we can sit down and say, well, that's over, even if it is over. I think we have to say, constantly monitor what is the long-term impact of that and be prepared to take care of the soldiers and families into the future.
Mm-hmm. Great. If anyone in the audience has any questions, we have a microphone here. If anyone would like to ask a question of one of our experts, you don't have to feel like you have to, but we are here and available if anyone has a question. Anyone? Great. If you could come on down to the microphone and identify yourself, and if your question is for a specific panelist, let us know, or if you just want to throw it out to all three of them, that's fine too.
My name is Philip Ludlow. I'm a recipient of VA benefits and also a local community member. Do you think that the addition of the Obamacare Act will create a stress on the local healthcare system with the free availability of healthcare to the general public?
I think that that's certainly a thought that's going across most communities across the nation. You know, the thought that we will see somewhere between 20 to 30 million more people with insurance and effectively needing to enroll with a primary care provider, and we already have a shortage of primary care providers, I think that that could create some stresses on the system. I know at Samaritan just this last week, and in anticipation of that, with the exchanges opening up here just next month in October, we've actually freed up some slots in our Samaritan Family Health Network clinic to try to anticipate that. But quite honestly, I don't think that was that will satisfy the overall need just for that aspect of it, which is more people being insured. There may be other stresses of the system as well that we aren't even familiar with at this point.
So you think that the addition of all of this it'll create more of a hamper for soldiers receiving benefits both on and off post?
I don't know it's just for soldiers. This is more for anyone who's not insured today that might be going and getting insurance. This is not necessarily in terms of soldiers or veterans, but more so just for the general population, particularly thinking about that group of citizens today that don't have insurance. Somewhere between 40 and 50 million people across America don't have insurance, and I'm told somewhere around 30 million of them are going to be able to enroll in the Affordable Care Act over the course of the next few months. When those 30 million people across the country become enrolled, that's where it's going to be challenging for communities that may not have enough access to primary care providers.
Okay, thank you.
And I think it's, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's unclear how many people are going to sign up for these exchanges. So it's a little bit of a guesswork at this point in time. And there will have to be a lot of adjustments made by folks like Tom and as we go and as we find out how many people really enroll in the program.
And it should be noted, here at least right around the Fort Del Mar installation, we historically have lower uninsured rates simply because of the fact of the matter. We have a good, robust TRICARE insurance for our military population. And New York State is a little ahead of the curve in our low-income insurances. So while we're going to see a pinch, that pinch certainly isn't going to be as great as it is going to be in some places across the country.
Right.
Rich. I think we'd be remiss if we're doing this in Jefferson Community College. The impact is really going to be on the education system, the medical education system. Denise touched on it earlier, how we grow our own up here in Jefferson County with successful programs and nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and the whole range of areas of medical specialty, and I think that's really going to continue to grow. A few years ago, we had a significant shortage of pharmacists, and that's been pretty much abated because of the response of the colleges developing programs. Same thing with physical therapists. Years back in the 90s, it was a real shortage area. So I think you may see that type of impact on the education system.
Right, because as you mentioned, there's a lot of emphasis on primary care, preventative care, community health centers. So, you know, those are areas where more personnel will be needed, and that's, you know, that need is being assessed as we go. Great. Any other questions from the audience for anyone? Terrific. Well, then we'll just end things up. That concludes our forum on healthcare for veterans in the military in upstate New York. I want to thank our panelists, Denise Young, Executive Director of the Fort Drum Regional Health Planning Organization, Thomas Carman, President and CEO of Samaritan Medical Center, a not-for-profit community hospital in Watertown, and Richard Kazel with the Department of Veteran Affairs, a hospital in Syracuse. Thanks to producer and engineer Mark Lavonier, and thanks to Jefferson Community College in Watertown providing us with this facility to hold this forum. This is the second in a series of 6 community forums on health topics, which WRVO Public Media is holding throughout our listening region. These forums are sponsored by the Health Foundation for Western and Central New York. I'm Catherine Loper. Thank you for joining us for this discussion on WRVO Public Media.